ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य काम्यञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतं स्वयं रूपकदमयं ददाति स्वपदन्तिकं वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरौ श्रीयुतपादकमलम् श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवंश्च श्रीरूपं सग्रजतं सहगणरघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सवाद्भूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपदं सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितंश्च हे कृष्ण करुणा सिंधो दीनबंधो जगतपते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचन गौरांगे राधे वृंदावनेश्वर वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिये वंशकौपतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्यैव च पतितानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नितानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे 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 कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे
हरे राम राम राम
Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15. There's a verse, Sarvasya Chaham, Hridi Sannivisho, Matar Smriti Yajnanam Apohanam Cha, Vedas Cha Sarvair, Aham Eva Vedyo, Vedanta Veda Vid Eva Chaham. We're going to pass out Bhagavad Gita. Oh, Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. What's that?
Page number?
607. Yeah. 607. Yeah, it's chapter 15, text 15. Swallows you like a giant clam. Yeah, Sarvasya Chaham, Hridi Sannivishto, Mata Smritir Gyanam Apohanam Cha. Vedascha sarvaira hameva vedyo vedanta krit vedavit eva chaham. I'm seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. Don't open it yet, I might not get to it. So again, I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas am I to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. So that's 15:15. Now, this verse is kind of interesting because it ties into something that I've been talking about lately. There's a little-known book that was written by Srila Prabhupada. Called The Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, the Golden Avatar. That's how it looks, you know. It's actually kind of a condensed version of the Chaitanya Charitamrita or something like that. But there's not so much pastime in it. Basically, it mostly gets down to the business of what was Lord Chaitanya's teachings. And first chapter to talk about Lord Chaitanya meeting Rupa Goswami, and then all the way from chapter 3 or so, all the way up to chapter 17, he talks about his teachings to Sanatana Goswami. And then in chapter 18 and 19, we hear about Lord Chaitanya and his meeting the Mayavad sannyasis and Prakashananda Sarasvati particularly. And so Lord Chaitanya preaches to them, and then later on he talks to Ramananda Roy, and there's a few others, you know. So that's kind of a... What's nice about this book is it kind of gives you a brief overview of all of the basics of Krishna conscious philosophy. There's not a lot of story in there, but there is a little bit. But mostly it talks about what Lord Chaitanya taught, and who he taught it to and when it took place. And particularly, what's interesting is this section where Lord Chaitanya meets Prakasananda Sarasvati. And he was one of the Mayavad sannyasis, and he met Prakasananda Sarasvati in the town known as Kashi, or Benares, or Varanasi. So the town has a lot of names. I didn't give it those names. It's supposed to be one of the oldest towns in the world that has been continuously inhabited, Varanasi. And Mark Twain said that Varanasi is older than history, older than human events, older than time, and it looks to be twice as old as all three of them put together. So, this town is quite well known because it was a stronghold or a place where a lot of impersonal philosophers would come and be there with their disciples. And particularly not so far away from Varanasi is a town or a suburb called Saranat. I don't know whether it's a suburb or an extra different town, but Saranat is a... It's part of Kashi. It's actually the location where there was a special group of Mayavadis. So Mayavadis come in different flavors. And this was a different type of Mayavadi. In this book, The Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, the Golden Avatar, Prabhupada tells us that the Saranat Mayavadis, they were closer to Buddhism than the regular Mayavadis were. And their idea was that everything needs to be measured in some kind of way. I don't know how that figures into their philosophy, but that's one of the things Prabhupada says in passing about them. And what
is different about them and the other Mayavadis is mostly we hear from people who are followers of Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya, of course, some people say 800 AD, some say a little earlier than that, but somewhere around that time, 800, 900 AD, Adi Shankara lived, and he taught this philosophy. And this philosophy actually spread quite widely, and it came to be that there were four big mats set up by the followers of Shankaracharya. One in the south, you know, which is the Sringeri mat, and one in the west in Gujarat, and one in the east at Jagannath Puri, and of course one in the north at Badrinath. So these were four different schools, and they're not identical. They have some different slogans, and they have a different organization to some extent. But basically, their understanding is that Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya, that Brahman is real, and the material universe, Jagan Mitya, is unreal. All form is fiction, including the form of the Supreme. So any kind of form is a part of the overall illusion. So the real goal of life is to study Vedanta. And by studying Vedanta, you come to realize that all form is illusion, and you should think that by living a very austere life, that you will merge with the totality of everything. The living entity is identical with God. Now, that's what the usual Mayavadis teach, these coming from Shankaracharya. The Sarnat Mayavadis were of a different sort. They taught that not even Brahman exists, which is very close to Buddhism. Buddhism teaches that not that there is something called the Brahman, there is nothing. That's why they're called voidists. So in Prabhupada's pranam mantras, we say nirvishesha and shunyavadi. So nirvishesha means no form. Shunyavadi means void. Shunya is the Sanskrit word for zero, guse, zik, zingo, you know, nothing. You know. So the idea of there being nothing or a void is the main philosophy of these particular philosophers, the Sharanat Mayavadis. And it's said that in Sharanat, at one time there was a lot of Buddhist stupas there, so I assume that there's some connection there between Buddhism and this particular kind of Mayavad. Lord Chaitanya, when he originally traveled, when he was first married in Navadvip, he left his home in Navadvip for some time, and he went to Srihatta, which of course now called Sylhet. But I would have never guessed that until some Bengali pointed it out to me, that Srihatta is like you shoot it at it with guns and it finally winds up being Sylhet, you know. And that it's the same place, you know. So Lord Chaitanya went there because his family has some connections there. And while he was there, he met Tapana Mishra and Chandrasekhar. And he asked them to move from what was then East Bengal, it's now Bangladesh. He asked them to move from there and to move to Varanasi. And they complied with his wishes, and when they got to Varanasi, they hated it because the town was full of Mayavadis. There were no Vaishnavas there. And so Lord Chaitanya came through on his way to Vrindavan, and he spent a little time with them. And, of course, Lord Chaitanya had recently taken sannyas at this point. A lot of stuff has happened. You know, this was some years later. At the time when Lord Chaitanya first came and met them in Srihatta, that at that time Lord Chaitanya was a householder. In fact, he had just been married to his first wife before she died. And later on, he would marry again, and then that marriage wouldn't last either because Lord Chaitanya would take sannyas. So this all happened between, the year, I think he first married in the year 1602 or 1601 or somewhere like that. And then he took sannyas in, when was it? Not, was it 16 or... He took sannyas in, what was it? I think I'm a century ahead. It's a 14. Yeah, he took. He was born in 1486. Took sannyas in 1510. That's what it was. He took sannyas in 1510. So Lord Chaitanya took sannyas only about 8 years after he first married. So his marriages, I don't think his first marriage lasted only about a couple of years, if even that long. And then there was some intervening time, and then he got married again, I think, the second time to Vishnupriya, Lakshmi Priya. She died by a snake bite of separation when Lord Chaitanya was in East Bengal. And that's when he met Tapana Mishra. So now Lord Chaitanya has decided to take sannyas, and he is been in Puri. He's gone on his South India tour. He came back to Puri, and he tried to go to Vrindavan one time, and he didn't go there. And then again, the third time he tried to go to Vrindavan, he was able to go. And on his way there, he stopped through, and he met Tapan Mishra and Chandrasekhar, who he had told to move then. And they said, my dear Lord, we hate it here. Lord Chaitanya had taken initiation from, I should make a clear point here, he took sannyas initiation from Keshav Bharati. He actually took his actual initiation from Ishvara Puri, but he took a sannyas initiation from Keshav Bharati. And that was a teacher in this Shankara school. Keshav Bharati was a teacher in the Shankara school. So naturally, when Lord Chaitanya first came through Varanasi, everybody in Varanasi thought, oh, this sannyasi, he's one of us. But Lord Chaitanya didn't spend any time with them. He ignored them completely. And he would chant and dance like he did everywhere else. And they thought, what's with this sannyasi, this new Bharati? He's one of us, but he doesn't study Vedanta. Instead, he chants and dances like a sentimentalist. There's something wrong with him. And they criticized Lord Chaitanya. And this bothered Chandrasekhar and Tapana Mishra. They didn't say anything to Lord Chaitanya when Lord Chaitanya came through, but he went to Vrindavan and he came back. And when he came back, then they said something to him. And they said, my dear Lord, all these Mayavad sannyasis, they're criticizing you for singing and dancing. They say you're a sentimentalist and that sannyasis have no business singing and dancing. They should study Vedanta. That was what a sannyasi actually should do. So Lord Chaitanya just thought it was funny. He smiled. But before I go a little further ahead with the story, I want to fill in some pieces here. That the whole idea that the Supreme Lord has no form is not a new idea. In fact, in one sense, we accept that. In Srimad Bhagavatam, in Canto 1, Chapter 2, I think it is, we have Vedanti Tat, Tattva Vidhas, Tattvam Yajganam Advayam, Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaneti, Shabdyate. And that says those who are knowers of the truth understand this non-dual substance, meaning the Supreme, as having three features, and they are Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So the seers of the truth understand this non-dual substance, meaning the Supreme, as having three features, or sometimes we say three aspects. So Brahman is the all-pervading feature of the Lord. Everything is made of the energy of Krishna. Ultimately, whatever you want to call it, however small you want to look at it, it's ultimately the energy of Krishna dancing around in little tiny packages. In the Vedic literature, they're called atoms or anu, you know, now scientists call them strings or whatever you want to call them. But it's, you know, the energy of Krishna doing these little backward flips and, you know, like Barnum and Bailey's three-ring circus. They're jumping through hoops backwards and doing all kinds of things. And we see it as reality, but it's actually Krishna's energies. It just pretend to be something that they're not. It's Krishna's separated energy, Bina Prakriti Rashtada. So he has separated energies. That's the material energy. And the living entities also emanate from him, but they're his superior energy. Bhagavad Gita tells us that again too. 7.4 and 7.5. We have that there are eight material energies. Bhumir, Apo, Nalo, Vayu, Kamana, Buddhir, Avacha. So we find that there's earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind and false mind, false intelligence, and false ego. Those are the subtle energies. And that's all dead matter, all of it. It's not really dead, it's Krishna's energy. But Krishna's told it like a little puppy dog to sit down and play dead. So it's not, it appears to be unsentient, it appears not to have any cognizance. But it actually is Krishna's energy. And it's got another property, Bina. It separates us from Krishna. It's amazing that you and I, every day, we live in a world where Krishna is in everything. He's the ground that we walk on. He's the air we breathe, the water that we drink, the walls of the houses that we live in. He's the food we eat. The things we think, he's everywhere. But we never see him in any of it. That's because Bina Prakriti Ashtada, this external energy of Krishna, is designed to hide Krishna from us. And it does a great job of that. And the only way we can not be taken in by Krishna's external energy is to develop devotion when we begin to see behind the mask of the material energy, that in fact it is Krishna's divine energy. We generally don't see that. And in general, for people who are not specifically trying to understand or appreciate the Supreme Lord, they will not see the divine energy as being the divine energy. They will see it simply as the material energy, and it will appear very mysterious to them. And so all this stuff, it's all Krishna. So Krishna is spread everywhere, not only in the material world, he's certainly everything in the spiritual world as well. So everything is the energy of Krishna. This whole categorization of external, internal energy, it's all coming from Krishna. So that collectively, we could say is the Brahman. Everything is Krishna's divine energy. However, Krishna has a localized energy too. That localized energy is called Paramatma, and it's God in the heart. So Krishna expands himself in the heart of everybody, in your heart, in the heart of everything else. Krishna is in the heart of the animals, the plants, the bugs, everything. He's in everyone's heart. He's even in the heart of every atom, material atom. So that localized feature is called Paramatma. It's actually expanded from the third Purusha incarnation. So Krishna expands, and ultimately down the line we have the Purusha expansions. First is Mahavishnu, then Garbha Vishnu, then we have Kshirodakshaya Vishnu. And Kshirodakshaya Vishnu is the super soul. So the super soul is also in every atom. So Krishna is in a specific way present in every atom, not in a non-specific way. As a non-specific way, he's in every atom, but he's also present specifically in every atom. He's also present specifically in everyone's heart. Then Krishna has a third feature, and we call that the Bhagavan feature, his personal feature. And that's his sweet feature where he's playing on a flute and he's dancing with the gopis. And sometimes he has other forms that he comes in. So Krishna has so many different forms. And all these forms are various expansions so that Krishna can be able to have all these different kinds of interactions. And now we begin to understand why both the material and spiritual universe really exist. They are like a big stage upon which Krishna can carry out his divine show. In the spiritual world, his divine show goes on forever, and the actors don't have to keep changing costumes like they do here. In Krishna's spiritual world, the stage can expand or contract as necessary, and things can be whatever they need to be for a particular pastime to be nicely manifest. Yoga Maya sees to that. She organizes whatever needs to be there. If it needs to be spring, if it needs to be fall, if it needs to be this, if it needs to be that, it can be arranged for Krishna's pastimes. In the material world, there is a usual progression of how things work. They're very limited, and sometimes they're nice for our pastimes, and sometimes they're not very nice for our pastimes. Usually people don't appreciate winter very much, especially when it snows as much as it did this last one. And we have to deal with it some way or another. So, but it's still a stage upon which Krishna carries out his pastimes. But in this case, the material world is different because it's a stage where we also carry out our own miserable version of Krishna being the supreme controller. We're thinking, no, we're going to rub Krishna's name out, the supreme controller, and we're going to get our magic marker and put our name there. And then we are trying to be what Krishna is. And it never works, but we try it lifetime after lifetime, and we think, I just had bad luck this time, but next time it'll work for sure. And we go on and on and on and on. One lifetime after another, we find a new way to try to enjoy like Krishna. And for some reason it never works, because the material energy can never fully satisfy us. And we are not Krishna, so as much as we might pretend we are, it will never work. But one of these days, we get bored with this whole idiotic thing of going life after life, going through various kinds of material rainbows. We chase them like sugar plums dancing in our head. And one year, one lifetime, it's this. The next lifetime is something else. And we chase and chase. And we wind up dying, you know, thinking, oh, my God, somehow or another it didn't work out. But I don't know where I'm going now. And at any rate, it's all over. But it isn't all over. We get a new body and we start it all over again. So Lord Chaitanya came because the age of Kali Yuga is the worst of all the ages. In Satya Yuga, mostly people are very pious. And the material world is not as degraded as it is now. People live very natural lives. They don't usually have to set up chemical plants and, have nuclear, energy and all that kind of stuff. They live off the land, and they don't need a big organizational government, and they don't need an army, and they don't need all this other stuff. They live very simply, and usually they spend a lot of their time meditating and performing various kinds of spiritual activities. And so in such an environment, they can live for a long time. And their prescribed way of merging or becoming part of the whole play of Krishna is through meditation. They meditate on Krishna's form in the heart as super soul. We just talked about that form. That's the middle form, not the Bhagavan form, not the Brahman form, but the Paramatma form. That's what meditation is designed to put us in touch with. Then things degrade a little bit. We have Treta Yuga, and then things degrade a lot more. We have Dwapara Yuga, and Krishna comes. And then finally we get to Kali Yuga, where they open all the slush gates and all the sewage goes in, and it becomes what we see today. And everybody who really doesn't want much to do with God, they get their chance. All right, beings, your time, you can come out and have your party. So Kali Yuga is like the party for all the people that really are not that much interested in God. And so naturally it's not a very good time. And Narada Muni saw that and he said, what do we do about these Kali Yuga people? And, you know, Advaita Chari, he had vanity. He said, what do we do about all these Kali Yuga people? It looks pretty bad. I don't know how we're going to deliver them. We need the Supreme Lord to come. So, of course, Lord Chaitanya decides to come in Kali Yuga so that people of Kali Yuga can actually have a way out. And they need, they can't do anything fancy, and they can't do anything really austere. Kali Yuga people are all, you know, kind of lazy bums and, you know, kind of half broken. So you can't ask much out of them. You can't get them meditate for 60,000 years. You can't get them to perform intense yajnas. You can't get them to worship deities according to very, very strict schedules. So you have to do something else. And so Lord Chaitanya came to give the Yuga Dharma, which was chanting the holy name of Krishna. So that's Lord Chaitanya's contribution. But actually, Lord Chaitanya came to do something a little bit more than that. He came to explain the process of devotional service. So not only do we chant, but we learn how to perform devotional service. He teaches about that. And today we're going to focus on yet one other thing that Lord Chaitanya came to do. And that was he came to explain that God is not formless. Not only is God not formless, but he has all kinds of forms. And that's one of the things that Lord Chaitanya came to do. And in this particular episode where Lord Chaitanya meets the Mayavadis of Benares, he has a chance to interact with these various people who are spreading this doctrine. And in this way, Lord Chaitanya tries to explain to people, not only by what he says and the philosophy that he speaks, but also, converting people who are Mayavadis, and also by his own personal actions. Lord Chaitanya was the Supreme. So, of course, nowadays, so many people claim to be the Supreme. As a matter of fact, when Prabhupada was here, he said that every year someone comes from India saying that he is a new God. So Prabhupada said, this India is like big God factory. It's manufacturing all these gods, and they come to the Western world, and people think, oh, this man must be God. And they have no idea what is God. God is no cheap thing, you know. So the question, of course, becomes, how do we know if someone is God or not? Anybody have any ideas? How do we go to Kmart and buy our God tester? And we have a little thing and we perform some kind of test. How do we know if somebody is God?
Predicted in the Shastra.
Yes, it's one of the main things he's predicted in Shastra. What else? Anybody have any other?
All opulence is knowledge, renunciation.
Yeah. That's also there. Yeah.
He's complete, he's full of everything.
Yeah, he's full in all opulences, all wealth, all strength, all fame, all beauty, all knowledge, all renunciation, and all... Which one did I leave out? Wealth, strength, beauty, knowledge, knowledge, strength,
renunciation.
Yeah, wealth we said already. Yeah. So, also Krishna has markings on his feet that others don't have. So, you don't notice any unusual markings on your hands or feet. You're probably not God. Sorry to break it to you, but. You're probably not God. And of course, the first thing is that God is always indicated in scriptures. Of course, when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya challenged Gopinathacharya that you say this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is God. How do I know that? The scriptures say that God only comes in three yugas. He's Triyugi. So Gopinath, he said, actually, that, you know, he is mentioned in the scriptures. And then he goes on to say, you know, in Srimad Bhagavatam, there's this verse about how we will descend in the age of Kali Yuga. Krishna Varnam Tusha Krishnam Sango Pangastra Parshadam Yagya Sankirtanaya Prayarya Jantihi Sumedashaha. That in the age of Kali Yuga, intelligent people will worship the Supreme Lord who always chants the name of Krishna. Although he is not blackish, he is Krishna, and he will descend with his servants, weapons, associates, and confidential companions. So that's a famous verse. I think that's in the 10th or 11th canto. I don't remember which. And he gave some other indications where in other Puranas it mentions that Lord Chaitanya would come as the son of Sachi Devi. It mentions that there would be an avatar who would take sannyas. You know, we hear all these avatars of Krishna. Which one of them takes sannyas? The only one I know of is Lord Chaitanya. You know, there's no other avatar that takes sannyas. You know, so all these indications are there, and we find that Lord Chaitanya fits the bill. So we are not just saying that Lord Chaitanya is directly God because he happens to be our favorite avatar or our favorite, exponent of some kind of philosophy, but there is evidence in scripture. But when people who knew that Lord Chaitanya was God, his devotees, they could sniff out that Lord Chaitanya was actually this avatar that was predicted, and they would refer to Lord Chaitanya as God. He would cover his ears and go, ksh, ksh. He did not like to be called God because he knew in the future everybody and anybody would come from India and call themselves God and people would believe it. So he was in that way indicating that the living entity is not equal to God in full. We are a particle, and Lord Chaitanya teaches to the Mayavad sannyasis. He says that it's like a bonfire. When you have a big bonfire, sparks fly out. And the big bonfire is the full representation of the Supreme. And the sparks are the tiny, tiny parts that come out. They are not the bonfire, but they have the same quality as the bonfire. They're also bright. They're also on fire, but they're not the same in quantity. So the hand is a part of the body, but the hand is not the whole body. So we are a part of the Supreme, but we are not the whole Supreme. We are only a part. So Lord Chaitanya came to underline this point. And we have this idea that Lord Chaitanya came not just as one form, but actually he came in a numerous group of forms. There's this verse, Panchatattvatmakam Krishnam Bhakta Rupa Svarupakam Bhakta Avataram Bhaktakyam Namami Bhakti Shaktikam. That we call it the Panchatattva, that there are five features. There's Lord Chaitanya, there's Nityananda, there's Advaita Prabhu, and then there's Gadadhar and Srivas. So of the three, Lord Chaitanya is directly Krishna, and Nityananda is the, as it says in teaching, it says it different ways in other books, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's listed a little bit differently. But in teachings of Lord Chaitanya, the golden avatar, Prabhupada tells us that Lord Chaitanya is actually directly Krishna, that Nityananda is the, or Lord Chaitanya is the form, Nityananda is the identity. We have Advaitacharya being the expansion. And then we have Gadadhar being the divine energy or the Shakti. And we have Srivas being the devotee. So all these are different aspects of the Supreme. Although the Supreme can come himself, Lord Chaitanya is directly the Supreme. He's directly Krishna. He's not an avatar of Krishna. He's actually Krishna. And Krishna's first expansion, Balaram, is Nityananda. So he's somewhat subordinate. But even more subordinate is Advaita Acharya, who is actually expanded from Mahavishnu and Sadashiva in one. So he is subordinate to the other two, to the manifestation of Nityananda and the manifestation of Chaitanya. But he is Vishnu Tattva. He's directly the Supreme. The other two are worshippers of the Supreme, and they represent the Shakti, or the energy. So we are also Shaktis of the Supreme, but we are very tiny. Whereas Gadadhar is the divine potency. He's like the representative of Radharani, or the Shakti Tattva. And Srivas is like the individual. So these two, Srivas and Gadadhar, they are servants of the other three. They are worshiper deities or worshiper expansions, whereas Chaitanya, Nityananda, and Advaita are actually directly the Supreme. And so Lord Chaitanya came and he taught devotional service. Particularly, he explained that there were rasas. And we know in Vedic literatures these rasas are explained as five. There's conjugal love, which is called Madhurya Ras. And then there is the rasa of parental affection, Vatsalya, the rasa of friendship, which is called Sakya Ras, the rasa of servitorship, which is called Dasya Ras. And finally, the neutral rasa of the yogis who meditate, which is called neutrality or shanta rasa. So those who worship Lord Chaitanya actually are destined for Madhurya rasa. That's what it explains in teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Sometimes you read things in somewhere like the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. You don't read it anywhere else, but it's there, you know, that those who are more interested in Sakya Ras or Vatsalya Ras will become followers of Nityananda or Advaita Acharya. So Prabhupada mentions that in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So the idea that Lord Chaitanya came to give us the idea of devotional service, to reveal the importance of this Madhurya Ras of the gopis, that it wasn't an accident or something that was somehow not quite kosher or something like that. He came to reveal the real dynamics of the love of the gopis. He also, as we said, came to show us that God is not formless. Not only is he not formless, he comes to us in a multiplicity of forms. So we see that Krishna comes as so many avatars. You have the Dasa avatars, you know. We hear about them, you know. Kurma, Matsya, you know, Vamandev, Nrsingadev, Ramachandra, etc., etc. The Dasa avatars are 10 avatars. There's a song by Jayadev Goswami which lists these 10, you know. And there's also in Srimad Bhagavatam, in first canto, about fourth or fifth chapter somewhere, that about 22 incarnations or 23 incarnations of Krishna are listed. Of course, how many are there? And the answer is they are limitless. But these are just 22 or 23 prominent ones. And so there are many forms of the Supreme. And one is not identical with God, as the Mayavadi philosophers would have us believe. One is simply a particle of God. And one does not want to merge with God. That can be done, but it's temporary, and it's not fulfilling, and that's why you cannot remain merged with the Supreme. You will eventually hanker after some kind of pastime, after some kind of emotion, after some kind of relationship. We cannot have a relationship merged with the Supreme. It's a dead end. And of course, one of the things that many people never stop to think about is if the all one is really the ultimate target of all spiritual conception, then we have to ask the simple question, why did that all one ever separate out into all these forms and varieties that we are now seeing? You know, what would have possibly been the purpose? If that's the highest form, then why did he create this lowest mess where there's all these different living entities competing and attacking one another and arguing and fighting? Why did he create it? Just so we could figure it out and get out of it. It seems like a pointless riddle or a pointless task. So either it is the highest thing. If it's the highest thing, then why did we leave it behind? And if it isn't the highest thing, why are we trying to go back to it? So the Vedic literatures do not teach that that's the highest thing. Rather, they teach the highest thing is a relationship with the Supreme. That can go on forever because Krishna is perfect playwright and he can keep coming up with new scripts for everybody to have various parts in. And that individuality or creativity does not vanish when we become a devotee. It becomes a part of our dynamic of interacting with the Supreme, interacting with Krishna. So that's another thing that Lord Chaitanya came to give us, both verbal and an example, and in that way he could explain this principle that we are not God, and nor is merging with the Supreme the highest goal of the Vedas. In fact, it's not very desirable. And Lord Chaitanya said that to merge with the Supreme is like hell for the devotee because it suppresses our identity. And how can we serve in a merged state? So the devotee is not at all interested in merging. And elsewhere we find in the Vedas that the bliss of material happiness compared to the bliss of merging is like an ocean to a drop. So material happiness, whatever we experience in the material world when our senses meet their objects, is like one drop compared to the ocean when we compare it to the merging of the entity into the Supreme. But that happiness is also compared to like a drop in the ocean, a drop to the ocean of the happiness of actually having a relationship with the Supreme. So the relationship is something that is not a static thing. It does not end. It's not a final point. It's not a garage where we park ourselves for the rest of eternity. It's something that keeps going on, and it keeps having new dynamics to it. So the devotees in the spiritual world, they're always part of new pastimes with the Supreme Lord. And even in the material world, the Lord comes sometimes to display his pastimes. So the poor fools in Kali Yuga who've rejected him can see his pastimes, and some might be inspired to leave the material world behind. So that's why he sometimes appears, and this is why he appeared as Lord Chaitanya, to reveal his pastimes. So as we mentioned, he had pastimes for about 24 years. So he had pastimes from the time he was born, you know, up until the time that he decided to take sannyas. And Lord Chaitanya had decided to cover the world, drown the world in love of God. The other day I was using this example that there was once a advertisement by a American company called Sherwin-Williams. They're a paint company. And maybe some of you have seen that, but probably unless some of you are old-timers, you've never seen this because it's a kind of an archaic advertisement. It shows a paint can, giant paint can, and the paint is coming out of the paint can and it's globbing itself all around the whole world and dripping off the bottom. And so one time Prabhupada saw that advertisement of Sherwin-Williams paint, and he said, yes, we should be like that. We should cover the world with kirtan. So this was actually Lord Chaitanya's mood. He wanted to cover the earth with love of God. And he said that even if someone had material desires, in teachings of Lord Chaitanya, it mentions that material desires are like seeds. They tend to fructify and they grow into a whole horrible plant of material entanglement. But if a seed gets too much water, if it's underwater, it can't sprout. So if the seed of material desire is drowned by the ocean of love of God, then even a seed of material desire cannot really sprout. So that's why Lord Chaitanya came to drown the inhabitants of Kali Yuga, the inhabitants of the world, in this ocean of love of Godhead. And he said, and I tried to do that, but some escaped. And those were the atheists and the Mayavadis and the Buddhists and the egotistic student class, he calls it. And he said, and some will escape to foreign countries. And those that escape to foreign countries, I will send my more Senapati Bhakta. I will send my general after them. And he will get them even in foreign countries. So this is Lord Chaitanya is explaining this, you know, that he will send. And so the idea is that Lord Chaitanya wanted to drown the whole world in love of God, but he saw that people didn't take him serious because he was a householder. So he decided he had to take sannyas because the sannyasis would never listen to him. And he wanted to reach not just householders, but he wanted to reach sannyasis too. So he decided to take sannyas. So in 1510, he went to Katwa, and there he got initiated by Kesha Bharati into the Bharati Mayavad school of sannyasis, because as far as we know, there were hardly, if any, there were Vaishnav sannyasis at that time. Generally speaking, Vaishnavs didn't take sannyas, they did something else. But Lord Chaitanya took this Ekadanda sannyas from Kesha Bharati, and then he began to preach love of Godhead. And he did it first, you know, in Puri. And then he, you know, traveled to South India, then he came back to Puri. And then wherever he would go, he would chant and dance. And this is what the Mayavadis of Benares were objecting to. They said, this man is a sentimentalist. He does not know that it's sinful to sing, dance, and to play music. This is not to be done. Because according to the Mayavadis, to try to expand sensory contact is the last thing you want to do, because you want to contract your senses and focus them on Vedanta. And by studying Vedanta, you begin to realize that everything in the material world is an illusion, and you just give it all up. And that's basically what the Mayavadis suggest for everyone to do. Of course, it's very tenuous, and you can easily get attracted by some material thing. So it's not so easy to do. And that's why such dry renunciation often fails. People may manage to keep a very austere profile for a long time, and then suddenly they blow it out on something. So Lord Chaitanya had heard that they were maligning him and calling him a sentimentalist for his singing and dancing. And now Chandrasekhar and Tapa Mishra had come to him, and they begged Lord Chaitanya to do something about it. And Lord Chaitanya smiled. And just as Lord Chaitanya smiled, a Brahmanan knocked on the door and came in, and he said, my dear Lord Chaitanya, I know that you're not in the habit of accepting invitations, but I have an invitation for you, because many sannyasis are coming to my house tomorrow, and they're all going to have prasadam, and I know that you don't usually come, but please come. And then the Brahmin threw himself at Lord Chaitanya's feet and begged Lord Chaitanya to please come to his home and accept prasad. And Lord Chaitanya had just been petitioned by Chandrasekhar and Tapan Mishra to do something about the Mayavadis and their criticisms of Lord Chaitanya's home. He thought, all right, I'll come. And he agreed to the Brahmin's proposal that he would come to the house. And he knew that who was coming to the program that they were having, like this one here, it was, you know, Prakasananda Sarasvati, one of the main Mayavadis. And he had many thousands of disciples, and they were all going to come, and they were all there with their, you know, ekadandas, you know. And so Lord Chaitanya, when he came into the assembly there in Varanasi of all the sannyasis, he did not come right up to the front of the room. Rather, Lord Chaitanya went to the very back of the room where people washed their feet. And so Lord Chaitanya washed his feet, and he sat very quietly in the very back of the room. But he expanded his divine effulgence. And of course, since Mayavadis are totally interested in the Brahman, they were naturally attracted by his, you know, effulgence, which is in fact the Brahman. And so he sat very quietly in the back of the room, and Prakasananda happened to notice Lord Chaitanya coming in, and he said, "My dear young sannyasi, why do you sit in the back next to the dirty area where people wash their feet? Please come up and sit here with us in the front." And Lord Chaitanya, he looked at Prakashananda and he said, "Actually, you all belong to the Sarasvata school. And as you probably know, I'm a Bharati. And I feel that I am not on the same class with you all. So it's probably best I sit in the back like this." Because Lord Chaitanya knew the whole protocol that in the Mayavad school there are different gradations of, you know, sannyasis. The Tirthas, the ashrams, and the Sarasvatis are considered top class, you know, Mayavad sannyasis. But the Bharatis are, I think, third or fourth class, you know, so they're not considered as high class of a sannyasi. Actually, when Lord Chaitanya first met Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, "I think this sannyasi, he's a Bharati. I should reinitiate him so he becomes a Sarasvati like me." And that's when Gopinath said, "You know, you don't need to do that. He's the Supreme Lord. He will not benefit from your initiation." But Lord Chaitanya understood that protocol. And Prakasananda, though, didn't go for it. He said, "No, you appear very effulgent. Obviously, you have made some progress in your understanding of the philosophy of Vedanta. So please come up to the front." And he grabbed Lord Chaitanya by the hand and he brought him up to the front where everybody was sitting. And so Lord Chaitanya kind of looked down and he came up to the front. And the Mayavadis who were sitting with Prakasananda Sarasvati, they became very immediately attracted by him. And Prakasananda, he asked the question that was on everybody's mind. He said, "My dear young sannyasi, I hear that you have accepted sannyas from the Bharati school. And we are all Mayavadi sannyasis just like you. Yet you never associate with us. And I see that you go into the marketplace and you're singing and dancing and chanting and these things. Why do you do this? And why do you not read Vedanta with us?" And so he asked Lord Chaitanya that question. And Lord Chaitanya answered that, "Actually, I could answer you, but I would say something and I'm afraid that you would not like to hear it." But they all replied, no, "We are very attracted by what you say. Please explain these things to us." And so they kind of set up the stage there, and Lord Chaitanya began to explain that, he was, first he said that you all say that you read Vedanta. But actually, you're not reading Vedanta, you're reading Shariraka Bhasya, which is the commentary on Vedanta by Shankaracharya. And actually, there are other Vedic literatures. and those other Vedic literatures also describe Vedanta. So Bhagavad Gita is also Vedanta. And so the Bhagavad Purana is also Vedanta. So the Mahabharata is also Vedanta. So I do read Vedanta, but I do not read this Shariraka Bhasya. So Prabhupada explains that that's when Mayavadis say that one reads Vedanta, usually what they actually mean is that somebody reads Shariraka Bhasya, which is Shankaracharya's commentary on Vedanta. So Lord Chaitanya, then while he's talking to the sannyasis, he mentions, and this is where I'll kind of wrap it up here, I could go on, but I'll just end it here because I haven't really myself read through for the how this whole episode ends. But as far as I've gotten is to this section where Lord Chaitanya explains to the Mayavadis. He says, actually, Shankaracharya is teaching a false philosophy. He's saying that Shankaracharya is Lord Shiva. And then Lord Chaitanya quotes a verse from the Padma Puran where Lord Shiva is speaking to his wife. Let me see if I can find it here really quickly. Srinu Devi Parakshyami Tamasani Hitakramam Yesham Shravana Matrena Patityam Janinamapi Apartam Shruti Vyakyanam Darshaloka Garhitam Karma Svarupa Tyajyatvam Atra Cha Pratipadyate Sarva Karma Paribram Shan Naishkarmyam tatra chochyate parama jivayor aikyam mayatra pratipadyate. My dear Devi, this is from Padma Puran. This is Lord Shiva speaking to his wife. My dear Devi, sometimes I teach Mayavad philosophy for those who are engrossed in the modes of ignorance. But if a person in the mode of goodness happens to hear this Mayavad philosophy, he falls down. For when teaching Mayavad philosophy, I say that the living entity and the Supreme Lord are one and the same. So he's explaining to these Mayavad philosophies that Shankaracharya is actually an incarnation of Shiva. And on top of it, that he's teaching a false philosophy. And this is also explained in the Vedas. He's not pulling it out of the hat. What's interesting is that Lord Chaitanya... He, at least superficially to the Mayavad sannyasis, appeared as if he was a sentimentalist just singing and dancing. But we know that if we back up in history, we know his previous life that Lord Chaitanya was living in Mayapur, or Navadvip. He was the most intense scholar, and he was defeating everybody. And pandits were afraid to tackle him because they knew they would be humiliated by his knowledge of Veda. So... he did that for a reason, too. He wanted to show, that bhakti is not some kind of superficial or sentimental view of the Vedas, that actually bhakti is the most rigorous understanding of the Vedas. And so now he's employing that detailed understanding of the Vedas to actually pick apart this entire Mayavad philosophy that they are all, engrossed in. And he's explaining here this idea that, of course, we can ask the question, why is Lord Shiva speaking a false philosophy? It seems like a reasonable question to ask. And then we have to put the whole thing into perspective because we find that Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna some 5,000 years ago, we can say roughly 3,000 BC. And after Krishna left the world, then Pariket Maharaj ruled for some time, and after Pariket Maharaj was no longer on the planet, then Kali Yuga came in. And in a short time, Vedic knowledge began to be misrepresented. And Vedic knowledge broke into six schools. And out of those six schools, the one that became the most prominent is the Karma Mimamsa school. And that school teaches that one does not need to consider whether there's a God or not. All one has to do is perform good karma, and you will get good results. And that's all there is to it. You don't have to know anything more. You don't have to do anything more. If there's heavenly planets, fine, you can go there. But we don't have to think about God. We don't have to think about anything else. Just perform your work. And this same school, this, Karma Mimamsa school, was also the school that started the tradition of large-scale animal sacrifices, where animals were killed and sacrificed and then eaten afterwards. So to stop this travesty of the Vedas against, it was actually all being done in the name of a Vedic philosophy. And so that's why the Lord sent Buddha. And he's about, 600 to 800 B.C., so from 3000 B.C. now we're at 600 to 800 B.C. And Buddha came to stop the animal sacrifices. And he did it by teaching a philosophy he called Buddhism. Prabhupada told us that Buddha didn't start Buddhism. It was already existing at that time. But he brought it to prominence and gave it kind of a name and some notoriety because of his own effulgence and ability to spread it. And he taught a philosophy that was probably 85% Vedic philosophy, but he told everybody to forget about the Vedas. So here it is. He's teaching a philosophy that's very similar to what he's rejecting, but he's rejecting the Vedas. And we advance up to, a few decades before, or maybe it's a couple of centuries, before Jesus, we have Emperor Ashoka. And Emperor Ashoka, he makes Buddhism important religion in India. Since he was an emperor, he had all kinds of means at his disposal, and he sponsored great Buddhist temples to be built in many places. And from what I understand, he was mostly in South India, but it did go up north to some extent. And so in a short time, most of the people that had before been Karma Mimamsakas, many of them changed their occupation to being Buddhist philosophers. And, what they had done before as Karma Mimamsakas, now they were doing under the heading of being Buddhists. And so Buddhism became much more prominent. And that went on all up until about the time of Shankaracharya. So now we have the reason why Shankaracharya comes. And he comes to put the picture of the Vedas back into the understanding of the population. So Shankaracharya, he preaches very strongly against both the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, which is still extant to some extent at that time, and he preaches against Buddhism. And he tries to get people to once again adopt the Vedas. And gradually, he makes some prominent disciples, and they make these four mats that I talked about in the beginning. And the philosophy of Shankaracharya becomes the winner of the day in India. As a matter of fact, it became so prominent that essentially Buddhism kind of lost its foothold in India. But it didn't leave... philosophers and the followers of Shankaracharya didn't pursue the Buddhists outside of India. So that's why Buddhism still remains in the rest of the Orient, while it had spread from India to China Japan, Korea, and all these other places it spread, and Thailand and all these places. The philosophers that were in the footsteps of Shankaracharya, they didn't go to those places to try to convert those people out of Buddhism. So that's why Buddhism remained there and becomes today very strongly situated in the Orient. But again, this is the reason why Shankaracharya came, why he was Shiva, and why he taught this partly incorrect philosophy. The main reason, of course, is that rather than try to bring people too far in one jump, that he did what was the next step necessary to bring people from Buddhist philosophy, which is voidistic, to at least the Mayavad philosophy, which is not voidistic, but it's impersonalistic. And then later on would come the Alvars in South India. And then we would have, you know, Natamuni and Yamunacharya, and finally, you know, Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya. And they would bring the whole picture back into personal philosophy. And Lord Chaitanya would come down through the school of Madhvacharya himself. But Lord Chaitanya was much later. So now the whole picture is reinstated back to what the Vedas really teach. They don't teach karma mamamsa. They don't teach certainly Buddhism. And they don't teach impersonalism. They teach personalism. And so that's what Lord Chaitanya was trying to get across. And there's a lot more in the conversation between Lord Chaitanya and these Mayavadi sannyasis, but I've given you some kind of background there, and we've been kind of talking about these things. So I'm going to stop there for tonight, and if there's questions or so, we can ask those questions. Yeah.
I have a few questions, but I'll start with one, and if I remember the others, I'll go.
Okay.
You mentioned how the Vaishnavas generally they didn't take sannyas. So what? But they did something else. What did they do?
They usually there was this. You know, at least in the later stages, they would become Babaji's. You know, that's actually what we see. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and we see, you know, Jagannath Das Babaji. We find in general in the Vaishnav, at least the Brahma Sampradaya, we find that for the most part, instead of taking sannyas, they became Babaji's. And it was Bhaktisiddhanta that decided to put sannyas back into the picture. And of course, here we see that Lord Chaitanya is taking a Mayavad, at least surfacely it appears as if he's taking a Mayavad sannyas. And he's doing that because people had a reverence for sannyasis in India, and he could use that esteem that sannyasis carry in India and use it for his preaching effect, you know. Whereas if he had become reclusive and become a Babaji or something like that, it would not have had the same effect. I think it was similar to that, although historically, there's probably a lot more to it than that, you know, and I might even be somewhat off the mark there, but as far as I understand, at least I know that's why it took place in Bhaktisiddhanta's time. In Lord Chaitanya's time, it might have been something else going on there, too. But in general, we find that the true knowledge of the Vedas becomes widely manifest, and then it becomes covered and only manifest in some small regions, and then again it becomes widely manifest again. So I'm sure there were Vaishnavas on the planet. We get that sense that there's an unbroken parampara, but they weren't very prominent, and what Lord Chaitanya wanted to do was to bring prominence to the teachings of the Vaishnav tradition, and that's why he wanted to spread it through the medium of being a sannyasi so people would take him seriously.
Three Dandi sannyasis started when?
I think the whole conception of Three Dandi sannyasi, it started for us with Bhaktisiddhanta. But from what I understand, Bhaktisiddhanta studied the other sampradayas where there was some examples of people taking sannyas, you know. We do hear about, you know, sannyasis. We hear about sannyasis in Lord Chaitanya's time, after Lord Chaitanya. Like, you know, Swarup Damodar was a sannyasi, and there are other sannyasis like that. But we find that doesn't seem to be a lot of sannyasis. So by Bhaktisiddhanta's time, everyone that he knew, they didn't take sannyas, but they took Babaji. And Bhaktisiddhanta thought that if you take Babaji, the whole conception of Babaji is you throw away your sacred thread, you become a non-entity in the Varnashram system. That's the whole conception of Babaji. You know, that as Lord Chaitanya taught, that, you know, I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not a Vaishya, I'm not a Shudra, I'm not a Brahmachari, I'm not a Sannyasi, etc., etc. That's the basic conception of taking Babaji, that you throw away all designations. And you are focusing on your bhajan, which is usually personal and solitary. And so how can you create a worldwide movement with people who are focusing on their bhajan and it's personal and it's solitary? So he wanted, how could you make it not like that? So I think, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta researched how people manage sannyasi, the ashram of sannyas, in some of the other sampradayas. I don't remember. And I don't know which one he studied. You know, maybe it was the people in the, you know, Vishnu Swami or the Ramanujans or, you know, the Sri Sampradaya or you know, the one of the other sampradayas. I don't remember which one he studied. But by doing that, he thought that he should take sannyas and not take Babaji. And so that's why, you know, Prabhupada took sannyas eventually. And that's why our whole movement comes down with this idea of we're not getting ourselves prepared to take Babaji initiation. We're getting ourselves prepared to either be vanaprast or to take sannyas, you know.
Another question.
Okay.
On the verse about Lord Shiva,
yeah,
coming, talking to Parvati, his other, the English you read is different than what I remember, so it's written differently. What I remember is, how I will appear in Kali Yuga as preaching clouded Buddhism to increase the population. I have understood how you increase the population.
Let me take a look at that because, you know, I'm just reading directly out of the book here. And there are what looks like three verses there, and there's only about two sentences there, so I'm sure there's a lot left out there. I was just going to take a quick look if I could sniff through any of the Sanskrit there, but it's all stuff that I don't recognize, so I can't give you a second guess on that. So I'm afraid I can't help you with that one. I've heard that in other places this verse indexed, you know, that this verse in Padma Purana is that, you know, Lord Shiva comes as, you know, Shankaracharya. And I do recall that the way Prabhupada translates it is different than the way he's translated here. But I don't remember what way it's different. I just don't have that strong a grasp on it, because I haven't run across it that often. But it's interesting that this was one of Lord Chaitanya's kind of first attacks on the whole conception of the Mayavad understanding. So he's teaching that the Supreme Lord is not one. He is many. And that what we want to do is actually develop a relationship with him. And, you know, in the end we find that he does win over the Mayavad sannyasis. Yes, you have a question.
Maharaj, maybe I missed some of the points, but I'm still curious to know. You said the Shankaracharya was incarnation of Lord Shiva.
Yeah.
And then, but we already said Lord Shiva is a great devotee of Krishna.
That's right.
Then why he created some? Because in the dark age, it's already everything is so difficult.
Yeah.
The Krishna philosophy. Then why Lord Shiva? He created something which will keep people away from.
Right.
I'm still curious.
Okay, well, I gave you one of the reasons. One of the reasons is that, as we said, by degrees, he brought people back, you know. So we find this as a common theme in the Vedic knowledge, that the Lord and his expansions teach according to Desha, Kala, and Patra. They teach according to time, place, and characteristics of those who are they're preaching to. Now, you know, if you're preaching to people who are 6 and 7, 8 years old, you don't preach quantum physics to them. You know, it's useless to preach what they can't absorb for one reason or another. So we find that many acharyas come. And that's why we have many religions too. Each of the acharyas is actually giving the people that he's preaching to the most they can handle, and giving it to them as clearly as he can. In some cases, he has to leave stuff out. And we find both of those things going on in the history of the whole exposition of spiritual life on this planet Earth, you know, that sometimes the acharyas or even the, you know, avatars have to leave some things out because either people are not ready for them, they can't grasp them, or people are too sunk in material life and they have to just get the next step and not the final step. So there's another thing, though, and that is that the material world is a place of options, and it's a place where one is able to choose with their free will to voluntarily follow the Supreme Lord or to reject him. So if the Supreme Lord only supplied reasons to follow him and reasons to accept him, then essentially it would be Xing out by margins the possibility of rejecting him. So sometimes the Supreme Lord actually plays the other side. He gives, you know, the atheists good arguments. He gives the material energy some things which make it look like maybe it's self-sufficient. He creates, and this is something I only learned about recently, he actually performs pastimes that foster illusion and not realization. You know, most of Krishna's pastimes that he performs help us to understand him better and help us to actually come closer to him. But there are a few pastimes that he performs really for the benefit of the atheists and for the benefit of the materialist, so they have something they can point at and say, well, see, so this isn't what you're saying it is. And, of course, an intelligent person will see that if you have 99 examples of one thing and one example that's the contrary, and you have on the other side of the coin somebody's pointing at the one example that's contrary and the other 99 examples they're ignoring, that there's something funny about the way they think. But nevertheless, that's why spiritual life takes careful thought, and why sometimes we see that people who have atheistic outlooks or Mayavad outlooks, they do have some apparent points that they're making. But in the larger picture, those points wash out because there's far more evidence on the side of, you know, taking to devotional service and so forth. So this is another reason why, you know, Lord Shiva does the whole thing. He, you know, people want to be atheists. So if you're going to be an atheist, the Lord has to help you by giving you good atheist philosophy. And so Shankaracharya came, and that was part of his business, to give atheists the philosophy they needed to kind of go on, you know. And maybe he sent Darwin for the same purpose or something like that. You know, you have all these various things you could look at, you know, that actually, you know, the Supreme Lord comes to basically bring people out of illusion, but at the same time, everything is coming from the Supreme Lord, either directly or indirectly, including false philosophy, including all these other things. So maybe that helps, I don't know.
Yeah, it means the Krishna is like testing the belief of your devotees.
Yeah. And, you know, if you came to the material world and there was not possible to reject Krishna, then essentially the material world has no function. You know, it's a place where you have the options. There's a nice verse in the 11th canto. When is it? Abir Bhutani Bhutatma Mahabhutar Mahabhujaha Sasar Cho Javachani Adya. What is it? The last line is the most important too. The Swamatra. I can't quite remember it, but the whole verse is the Nama Yogendra speaking to Maharaj Nimi. And one of the Nama Yogendras is explaining to Maharaj Nimi that the Supreme Lord creates this universe and sends forth living beings in higher and lower species. So to facilitate their prasidhaya, swamatra, something prasidhaya, that it could facilitate their material life or their spiritual quest, either one. You know, so the material world is poised to help us immediately, whichever direction we want to go. If we want material life, the material world will give us reasons for it and will give us facility to expand our desire for material life. It doesn't hamper it. It gives us facility. And the same token, if we want the other thing, if we want to increase our spiritual life, the material world will help us to do that too. So Krishna is allowing both sides, you know. And if there was no free will, then essentially we'd be robots, you know. We would, and if we were forced to love Krishna, that would make love impossible, because love has to be a voluntary act. And of course, in the spiritual world, it is also voluntary, but there nobody is misusing their independence. If you decide to misuse it, you come here instead, because you can't, there's no facility for actually acting out your rejection of Krishna in the spiritual world. You have to come here to do that. And here it is possible. And so Krishna nicely allows you to do that if that's what you want to do. And, you know, sooner or later everybody figures out it's a dumb thing to spend your time knocking around in this place, reincarnating, you know, all sorts of different conceptions. And so one last thing I'd like to tie in is we started with the verse 15:15, which is about, you know, the Supreme Lord. He says he is Vedanta in that verse. That's one of the things. So Lord Chaitanya is being accused of not studying Vedanta, but Lord Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita that he is the end of the Vedas. So he's not saying Brahman is the end of the Vedas. He's saying he is the end of the Vedas. And he's the knower of the Vedas and he's the compiler of the Vedas. So that's part of the argument that Lord Chaitanya uses too. Okay. Any other questions? Let's let Ramananda ask a question and I'll get back to you, Puri.
Just what you just now said about 99 things says, you know, it's this, and then one says it's not.
Yeah.
So what do you do? I mean, we're using that same argument for the scientists when it comes to evolution, that there are these anomalies.
Yeah.
And so we're saying that, so what should we do? Say, well, we shouldn't really pay any attention to that because the 99% of it says it's, you know.
But they're not anomalies. That's the whole thing. Yeah.
Well, they're anomalies in the sense that according to all the evidence they have, humans were not here at a certain time.
Uh-huh. You know?
And then there's once in a while something comes up that seems to indicate there were humans. So we bring that up, and one of the arguments that I've heard against that was, you know, then you'll never be able to come to any conclusion.
Right.
Because you know, there's, you know, a couple of things. So what you're saying with the 100, you know, 99, and the 1, I think you have to consider that 1 too. You can't just say, well, that 1 is just...
Well, you could consider it, right, but that's what we mean by weighing arguments. That as far as I can see, the material world is designed to give us the ability to come to any conclusion we want. It doesn't have to be a correct one or an incorrect one. You know, it can be reasonable, it can be unreasonable. So we can come to any conclusion we want. But an intelligent person weighs the evidence and naturally comes to the conclusion that seems to be the most likely of several possibilities. And, you know, there's no truth that's so sure, you know, from an empirical point of view and a social platform, that's so sure that everybody just has to believe it. Nor is there anything that's so obviously, you know, rickety and unbelievable that there isn't somebody out there who will take it seriously. But intelligent people will weigh through all that and say, well, yes, what you say might have some kind of bearing, but there's too much evidence against it, so this is what I'm going with. You know, you may go with what doesn't have much evidence. But then, talking about your whole thing with the scientists, I haven't seen that they have even a preponderance of evidence on their side, you know, as far as I can see. They're the ones with the minimal, you know, evidence, especially if we're talking about evolution, you know, because the whole theory of evolution is based on a lot of suppositions, and it's got no actual empirical evidence. We see that things change. You know, nobody's denying that things change over time. That's obvious. And the Vedas even agree with that. But that's not what evolution is with a capital E, you know. If we just want to call it evolution change, then I agree with evolution. But that's not what evolution theory is. It's more than that. And we could say that evolution means that one thing changes into something else. That has to be demonstrated, you know. Because you find a couple of bones over here, and you assume they came from the same thing. And you try to put them together and create a half man, half ape. Of course, we know that there were half man, half apes. You know, we just went through Ramachandra's pastimes, and he had a whole group of them working with him. You know, so we don't argue with that. But we don't say that we descended from them, and that's what we actually explain, that, you know, humans have always existed, and monkeys have always existed. And the fossil evidence certainly is not a slam dunk that, you know, that it demonstrates beyond a shadow of a doubt. Because we see these fossils pop up of, you know, apparently very modern human remains in strata that's so old that it cannot be, you know, recent. It has to be, you know, beyond the scope of our modern Darwinian idea of when humans, modern humans, were supposed to be walking the earth. So, you know, there isn't just one, but there's a number of those things. And once we talk about that ancient fossil evidence, all fossil evidence is not abundant. There's not much of it, you know, when you really talk about it. So there's not like you've got a huge, you know, bucket load of things on one side and a few things on the other side. It's really, you've got a few fragments on this side and a few fragments on that side, and whatever conclusion you want to pull out of it is depending on your whole outlook on life. You know, if you really believe that the whole idea that material energy builds on itself brick by brick and creates complexity, that's the whole picture that Darwin and his evolutionary theory give us. But the Vedic conception is far different than that, you know. Yeah.
It's a little bit off course.
Yeah,
this,
yeah.
Discussion. Is there any such thing called finding a balance between the spiritual, personal, and professional life?
Mm-hmm.
If there is any, will it lead to the moksha?
Yeah. Well, for us, moksha is developing love of God. That's how we define it, or liberation. We'll probably be talking about that tomorrow when we're talking about verse 258, because it's talking about withdrawing the senses. But the idea of moksha or liberation means that we develop a full love for God. And that can be done in any ashram, and it can be done in any varna. It's not exclusive to the sannyasa ashram. It's not exclusive to the Brahman ashram, you know, or Brahma varna. Anyone can develop that. But what Bhagavatam teaches is actually, what is that verse? Let me see if I can remember it. I can't think of it, but it's a Sanskrit of it, but it actually says in English that one desire should never be aimed at sense gratification. Rather, one should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. Since a human being is intended for self-realization, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. You know, so what we're saying there is that we will have a professional life. We will have, you know, necessities of the day. And those have to be met. But gradually we learn the balance of paring down our material necessities and expanding out our spiritual activities. You know, so we're doing one, we're doing two things that are in opposite directions. And over time, we begin to realize there's a lot of material things that we could do without, and we don't really need them that much. And by cutting down our material picture of what we need, we find that we have more money and more time left. And with that extra money and time, we can use that to push forward Krishna consciousness and drown the world, like we were talking about it, for Chaitanya's vision, you know. So this is kind of the good basic way to understand it. And over time, it becomes easier, because also as you progress in Krishna consciousness, you become less attached to things. So you begin to see that I don't really need all this and that and the other thing. I can minimize those things, and I'll still be able to live, but I'll have more time and freedom. And with that, I can preach. And so both things happen concurrently. And this is how Krishna consciousness gradually takes place. You can always keep this in mind as you go forward in life. And everyone who has any kind of, life of whatever kind it is, has to always think, how can I more maximize what I'm doing on a spiritual level and minimize the things I think I need on a material level? And then gradually you can begin to realize the difference between the two. Does that help at least? Yeah. You have a question.
You mentioned in part of, in some part of your conversation,
yeah,
about these people who they were looking for a simple life to spend more time meditating.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that exactly, is part of that what you are talking about right now?
No, not so much meditation. Meditation was there in Satya Yuga. We were saying that Satya Yuga was thousands and thousands of years ago, at a time where Darwin tells us there were no human beings on the planet. But, just like right now we're experiencing spring, I think we are. I'm not really sure yet, but but it should be about time for spring. And previously we just went through winter. And winter has certain characteristics. Spring has different characteristics. Summer has yet different characteristics. And fall has different characteristics. And we know that after fall, there's another winter. And after winter, there's another spring. And so just like there are four seasons, and they occur every year, the Vedas explain that there are four ages, and they cycle exactly the same way. So in this case, Satya Yuga is like, you know, summer, or actually spring, and Treta Yuga is like summer, and Dwapara Yuga is like fall, and Kali Yuga is like winter. And but these are not so quick as our yearly cycle goes. That actually Kali Yuga goes for 432,000 years. That's the duration of Kali Yuga. And Dwapara Yuga is twice that long, so it's 864,000 years long. So that's Dwapara Yuga. Treta Yuga is three times as long, and I can't crank the math fast on that one. So, Satya Yuga is four times as long. So what we learn is that 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 equals 10. And then the whole cycle of all four ages in is 10 times the duration of Kali Yuga. So if Kali Yuga is 432,000 years long, then the whole, what's called a Divya Yuga, the equivalent to a yearly cycle in our smaller segment of time here, equivalent to that, then means that the Divya Yuga is 4,320,000 years long. And then we start over with another Satya Yuga. So Kali Yuga still has 427,000 years left. We've just started it. It started about 5,000 years ago, approximately. So we have 427,000 years of Kali Yuga left, and then Satya Yuga starts. And then there's another Treta Yuga. And so this keeps cycling and cycling and cycling. And so this entire world is like one of those, buildings in downtown Manhattan where at one point people are selling shoes there, then they go out of business, somebody opens a pizza restaurant in there, and then after that somebody comes in there and they're, you know, it's a travel agency for a while, and then somebody, you know, sells real estate for a while, then it goes, nobody's in there for a while, and then, you know, Apple buys it and they have their, you know, computers in there for a while. So it's just constantly a stage where one civilization comes and kind of does its thing, dies out, and a new civilization builds over the top of it, and after a while you can't tell the other one was ever there, and we just move one after another. And so some of these things that we see on the earth come not from our particular group of historical episodes, but even from ancient times. So this cycle keeps going over and over again. And in Satya Yuga, during that time, people generally are not so materially popped out as they are in this era, in Kali Yuga. So they don't need all that stuff. They don't hanker for all that stuff. And they have a much longer period of life, you know. We were talking about the other day that even the Bible suggests, you know, that some of the ancient, people were living 800, 600, 900 years. And the Vedas say the same thing, that in Krishna's time, of course, Krishna was on the planet for about 125 years. And that was he was at the end of Kali Yuga, at the end of Dwapara Yuga. But earlier, you know, in that same Yuga, people were living for not 100 years like they do now, but for 1,000 years. And in Treta Yuga, people live for 10,000 years. And in Satya Yuga, people live for 100,000 years. So people had a much longer duration of life because the elements were different. You know, we look around, we see air and we see the sun, and we have all these things around us, where we see the plants and the animals. In Satya Yuga, things were much more powerful and much more strong and able to resist various kinds of, damage and accident. You know, they could, fruits were much more succulent and things were much brighter and tastier and more powerful at that time. But as we get closer to Kali Yuga, that diminishes, where our life expectancy diminishes, the quality of our food diminishes, everything diminishes, our eyesight, our health in general, and we find instead of having lifespans of 1,000 or 10,000 years, we have lifespans not even of 100 years hardly. So that's part of the whole, how the thing cycles. And of course, after Kali Yuga, we go back to another Satya Yuga where meditation's practical again. You know, it's not practical in this age. We don't live long enough. Our world that we live in is too disturbed. You know, there's too many things going on that make meditation impractical in this age. Oh, there's nothing against it as a technique for calming down, nothing against it as a health benefit, but it's not a spiritual path in Kali Yuga. It won't get you where you need to go, you know. But, yoga and meditation is good as far as health goes, if that's what you're doing them for. But, as far as a spiritual path, it won't actually fill the, you know, necessity for that. Maybe that helps. I don't know. Okay, one more question.
I'm just a beginner. This moment, although I'm very inclined, devotion services and all this feel great.
Mm-hmm.
Why there's a magic number of 16 japa malas per day?
Why?
16. Why 16 came into play?
Yeah, how it came about. Lord Chaitanya, when he came, one of the main messages he came was this conception of chanting the holy name. You know, he pulled a verse out of the Kali Santarana Upanishad, and that verse was Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Iti Sudarsakam Nam Nam Kali Kalma Sunasanam, Nata Parataropaya Sarva Vedeshu Drishyate. By seeing all the Vedas, Sarva Vedeshu Drishyate, one becomes aware that this 32-syllable, 16-word mantra, Hare Krishna, etc., is the best way to overcome the pernicious effects of this age of Kali Yuga. So the Yuga Dharma that Lord Chaitanya gave was, out of all the possible spiritual practices we can do, the most powerful, the most efficacious, is the process of chanting the holy name. And that will cleanse the heart and cleanse out the material desires more than any other thing that we do. And so Lord Chaitanya established the idea that we do kirtan, which we do with musical instruments, but we also do japa. And japa entails something we call a nirbandha, or a commitment to a certain quantity. And so, as far as I understand, in Lord Chaitanya's time, they used to do the quantity by using their fingers. They would count like that. Later on, devotees came to the stage of deciding to use beads because it was easier to count. You didn't have to do so much mental math while you're trying to chant at the same time. The idea of chanting, of course, is to focus on the sound vibration, because the mind tends to ramble about all kinds of things. But that's exactly what we're trying not to do. We're trying to bring the mind away from various kinds of rambling and hear the sound vibration. Now, as it's come down to us, from Lord Chaitanya, generally it appears that the devotees in Lord Chaitanya's time would shoot for some figure like 300,000 names daily, which is a huge number. And in Bhaktisiddhanta's time, he suggested what we now call 64 rounds. And so that's also a huge number. But when Prabhupada came to the United States, he felt that Westerners would never be able to manage that kind of quantity of chanting. So he reduced it to 16. And even that is quite a lot. And certainly I would not go from 0 to 16 in one step. I think that's usually a bad thing. You know, it tends to be overambitious. Because what you want to do is to gradually get to the point where you're chanting the same amount every day. Not that you chant a lot one day and not anything the next day, sort of, etc. The idea is that you're doing it every day. It's a part of your everyday practice. It's sadhana. Sadhana means everyday practice. So it's a part of your everyday practice. And you're chanting. So you want to gradually increase until you come to 16 rounds and not kind of realize that you've kind of gotten in over your head. So it is possible to live a life around 16 rounds, you know. Those people who are initiated devotees are all supposed to be doing that. And so it's a prerequisite for actually becoming initiated in the Hare Krishna or ISKCON movement. And the best way is to gradually increase until you get to that stage, to chant 2 or 4 rounds for some months and then chant 6 or 8 for some months, and then gradually come to the stage of where you're chanting 16. And this has more effect in our lives than any other thing that we do. And sometimes it's hard to understand how that's possible, but it is possible, and I firmly believe it. You know, when I'm chanting better japa, it makes the whole world a very different place for me, you know. That Krishna has pledged to come in the form of his holy name. And when we chant his holy name, we're purifying our heart, we're purifying our consciousness, and then Krishna is actually helping us throughout the whole day to do whatever we have to do, to meet whatever challenges we have to meet, to be able to make spiritual progress on a regular basis. Because the only thing that really holds us back from spiritual progress is our material desires. And there's nothing that gets at the root of that problem the way that chanting does. And that's why Prabhupada recommended 16 rounds. And he actually said that 90% of the progress we make in Krishna consciousness is based on the quality of our chanting. If we kind of do it begrudgingly or fit it in the margins, it'll have... Even, it's said that even if you do it reluctantly or neglectfully, it still has immense power. But we should not do it that way. We should actually do it very deliberately and with with the intention to focus on very clearly the holy name. And that way it'll have a lot of power and quickly bring us out of the modes of nature into spiritual life. Because if we continue to chant neglectfully, then eventually we'll lose our taste for chanting and we'll just give it up, which is certainly not what we want. All right, there's much more that could be said, but I'm just giving you the Reader's Digest version. All right, so what happens next? I don't know who are...
His Holiness Chandrasekhar Maharaj ki
jai.